In every city, there are people who, for one reason or another, have a hard time finding a place to live. I mean, a really hard time. Not just the difference between buying a house or renting a condo. This is the difference between finding a place to lay your head at night or being out on the street. I'm Harry Forrestel, and this is Maritime Magazine. Recently, freelance reporter Leslie Lowe had a chance to learn about some of these people in the region's largest city, about the conditions in which they live, conditions many of us would be shocked to know are happening right under our noses. And she found out that even those meager accommodations are disappearing. As we begin our 52nd season here on Maritime Magazine, we bring you Leslie's documentary, Hidden Homes.
And where are we going?
We're just gonna swing over here to Sackville Street, to an iconic rooming house in our downtown core.
Iconic, but most of us don't even know it's there.
That has been around for years and years, and within the next couple of years, we'll be gone.
This rooming house will disappear, and we probably won't miss it. And the people? We don't notice them now, and probably won't when they're gone, either.
Yeah, so this is this small three-story building has 15 rooms in it for folks, mostly older men, so men 40 plus, mostly men who have been chronically homeless throughout their lives, who have various struggles and challenges, be it alcohol.
This building is on a central downtown corner. There's a lingerie store called Night Magic Fashions, and Halifax's best-known comic book shop used to be in the basement.
And some of these guys have been here for quite a while. So this building was sold, well, this block was sold, I think about 4 or 5 months ago.
It's across from this giant hole in the ground, where the city's brand new $500 million convention center is going up. This block's been sold, and the 15 guys who live upstairs have been told they're gonna have to go.
The great thing about this spot is we are 3 blocks from a lunch program that happens Monday through Friday. We are 2 blocks from a lunch at St. Paul's that happens every Wednesday. We're a block from a supper that happens every Friday afternoon at the other church.
But this isn't just a story about development or gentrification or displacement. These people are losing their crappy rooming house because the land is valuable. But that's not the whole story.
So folks here are really central in terms of access to food. So when you're living in poverty and you're paying $535 for one of these rooms and you have, you know, $200 to pay for all your bills and everything after that, yeah, it's great to be central.
Fitting to have the banging in the background. Anyway, okay, I'll get you to introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Sean Michael Suva, 44 years old, resident of Halifax, and I go by the street name Irish.
Irish?
Yeah.
Why Irish? Tell me that.
Just Irish background, and when I was a little boy, I grew up with 7 sisters, and my grandma would always come in the house and say, "Where's that little Irish boy?" And then just my street name and my attitude stuck to it, and that's just how the world knows me, yeah.
Irish used to live in one of the city's no-good rooming houses. This one actually sits on a leafy green street on the Dalhousie University campus. You would never know by walking by.
Tell me what it's like inside.
It's quite dirty and disgusting. It smells foully of body odor. There's one actual kitchen with a stove and a fridge in it that is intended to be used for 24 apartments. Yeah, with a stove that doesn't work. And a fridge that's rotten away with food and nastiness in it and dirty dishes. And nobody wants to clean up the other guy's mess. So there's 24 apartments in total, including two separate ones, so 26 in total. And there's 2 bathrooms, and there's in the common areas, there's 2 bathrooms upstairs. And on that floor, there is 4, 8. So out of 16 of the apartments, there's 2 bathrooms for 16 people. And then downstairs in the basement here where I live, there's 3 rooms, and there's 1 single bathroom there for 3 guys, which is was shared by me.
In case you're not catching that map, that's 26 rooms with as many men using one kitchen and three bathrooms.
Just broken down and old and just not like from the outside. It looks like every other house on the block. But you go inside the door and just the smell of it. You can't see because we're on radio, but just inside this door is all broken glass and boarded up windows on the inside of that blind right there.
Irish lived here from August of 2012 to February of this year. Then he got out.
Yeah, I live with a Christian brother of mine from church and got a job there as a resident caretaker and clean, sober house. Just two buddies living together. And it's huge and beautiful. And I pay the same rent there as I do here. Actually, $30 more. And I live in a three-bedroom den on the fourth floor on the harbor. Yeah. Yeah, wow. If you saw my place, Les, you'd go, wow, yeah. That's what I do every time I walk in. I'm like, wow. I can't believe people are stuck in these places.
It's not that simple for everyone. Most people stay in rooming houses because it's the only kind of housing they can afford. And, often more importantly, it's the only housing that works for them. Now, this is the part that will probably surprise you. It's the true secret of rooming houses. Not that they can be really terrible, and not that they can exist right under your nose, but that they are exactly the right kind of housing for some people.
The positive of rooming houses is that it's traditionally an option for folks who otherwise would be in a shelter or on the streets. You know, folks who don't clean up really good, whose social interaction skills are limited because of the struggles they have.
EJ Davis is the person showing me the Night Magic building, even though we can't go inside. He's a downtown street outreach worker. He knows lots of guys like Irish, and he's really worried about the men who've been living here.
You know, it's, I think historically, it's been a model that, you know, you put these 10 guys that were here, they've upped it to 15, but the original 10 guys, a lot of them had been here for years and years, and, you know, we're kind of a little self-sustained community and would look out for each other, and, you know, if someone was not doing well, they would know who to call to check, you know, make sure that person was checked out.
EJ says what often happens in these situations is that the men rely on each other, since they don't really have anyone else. Like any community or family, that can be hard to give up. Claudia Yon's office is above a Wendy's on a busy central street. And I must have passed it a million times.
I've never been up here. It's actually quite nice.
She's the program facilitator with the Affordable Housing Association of Nova Scotia.
So rooming houses in every country were always a fully accepted, very, very important form of tenure. Very important. So that the old.
I'm here for a little history lesson. Not long ago, rooming houses, or boarding houses, were go-to places for bachelors, single women, and seasonal workers. There was usually a den mother in charge, a live-in owner.
So sometimes food was included. In some forms for rooming houses, you define them actually that you have your room and you share one or two facilities, so the kitchen and bathroom. If you look in England in the old movies, you always see that.
And that's what I was going to say. In pop culture, you think about, you think about that. That appears all the time.
It dawned on me yesterday. And it's really like student living too, right? Shared, co-housing options. And this is actually a very economically feasible way to live. You share the resources. So usually you have a room you pay by week. That works for many workers who get paid weekly very well. You have community. You're not things. If you don't have furniture and all these other expenses, perfect. And some
people, they never. Then a shift. Society changed. The den mothers could be employed in other ways and were. Without live-in owners, conditions worsened. Rooming houses stopped being appealing to the working class and became one of the only options for the poor. All the while, land values are rising.
75% of the rooming house stock got lost.
So when was this?
Okay, I have the number. Yes, I found this nationally. Yes, 20 years ago. He said the closing of 75% in Canada's rooming house during the past 20 years resulted in more overcrowded shelters. So we have to think, why do we have this homelessness issue? There's already one reason. Right. 75% of rooming houses nationally closed. Where do you go from a rooming house situation?
So with fewer rooming houses to pick from, those who need them, their affordability, and their social setup have a harder time finding their spot. And where do you go when you can't find space in a rooming house? When you've already been priced out or booted out of the traditional rental market, you end up in a homeless shelter.
So now we know why our shelters are overcrowded. 20 years ago, Etzem House had 2 clients, now they're booked. So how does this happen? Rooming houses, group homes, all these kinds of things. Loss of affordable housing options.
Maybe you're wondering, so what? If you're sharing a filthy toilet with 25 other guys, isn't it better to go to a nice clean shelter until you get back on your feet? I'll tell you one problem with assuming a shelter is a good replacement for a crappy rooming house. Cost.
We know already that just housing 1,700 individuals in 2010 in HRM came as a price tag of $24 million, just for HRM. This is a shelter cost, the sheltering cost, plus the cost to the justice system and, most importantly, the health system. Because as you can imagine, as soon as a person is in a shelter system, you cannot access regular services like a family doctor. So you go to the emergency, you get more frequently picked up by police, you access the most expensive services most frequently.
$24 million to shelter 1,700 Haligonians in 2010. In 2012, there were almost 2,000 people in shelters. As more and more rooming houses close, more and more people enter the shelter system. We don't know when they'll hit, and we don't know how many there will be, because so many rooming houses are hidden.
So tell me the worst you've seen.
I've seen the basement of a building, so 6-foot ceilings, gravel floor, open sewer, with 2 folks renting that space. So 2 folks at $535 a month renting a space with a door that was a 5-foot door, so, you know, one of those emergency access hatches out of your basement.
$535 is a number that keeps popping up. It's the community services housing allowance for people who aren't able to work. $535 covers rent and utilities. And in some cases, it's paid directly to landlords.
When there's the intersection of a really horrible landlord with the potential to get $535 out of each person they can get into their building, I've seen various things to maximize the number of people in a space. So I've been in spaces in rooming houses where they'll take a room that's 10 by 10 and just stick up plywood to make it into 3 spaces or 4 spaces, and then it's $535 for each space. You know, they don't have access to kitchens, or they don't have access to a shower. There's one tub, or there's one toilet for 10 guys.
Okay. Well, why don't we go in, and I'll just kind of do my inspection as we go, and you can show me where your problems.
Compared to the things EJ has seen, this place isn't so bad.
Check for hot water. Your landlord has to provide hot water.
No matter how long Adam Sadler runs this tap, there is no hot water coming out. Adam's an assistant building official with HRM. He's one of the guys who goes into a residence, any rental property, when the city gets a complaint.
There's definitely ebbs and flows when the students, university students, move in and out. So September, August, September.
The inspections are called M100s after the bylaw. Adam's looking at whether properties are safe to live in, based on a checklist. He looks at smoke detectors, hot water, whether there are enough exits from bedrooms, and ventilation in bathrooms.
What's the worst you've seen?
I've seen some pretty interesting living conditions. Like, I don't know how much I'm allowed to say, but there is... Yeah, people live in a manner that I obviously wouldn't want to. yeah.
But Adam can't go in unless a tenant calls directly. The city doesn't deal with rumor or secondhand complaints. Licensed rooming houses are inspected annually, and there's a list of those. There's no list of the hidden ones. And no matter how bad those are, Adam rarely gets called. Because a tenant who's fearful of losing the meager housing he has isn't likely to put up much of a stink.
And I landed in here, and I was angry, pissed, and terribly angry, you know? It's all right, Gary. Yeah, Gary, you love him.
At Irish's old rooming house, his buddies barely want to talk to Irish when I'm standing beside him with a microphone.
Sweetheart of a guy.
Gary has just come out.
They can't find anywhere to put him.
Nick sits on the steps away from us and pretty much stays silent.
They fixed the kitchen in there yet? Kitchen upstairs working? No. You know?
But Irish echoes what others have been telling me. No matter how bad the rooming houses are, the answer isn't to split guys like this up and send them across the city to different shelters, or even to subsidized apartments.
Most of us that live in these places, we end up here because our families have given up on us, or we've given up on ourselves, or we're injured, or we just simply can't afford an apartment, or some kind of pain has broken our heart that we just don't want to give it the full-on effort anymore, so we just want to recluse. And it generally seems to be more men than anything. We just want to recluse and we're happy. Men are content. Like, it's funny. They're like little monkeys, you know. Just give them a little room. And you know, just seriously, they are. It's funny how many people are happy just to come home at night and not have to bother with nothing.
See, when the rooming house model works, it actually really, really works. It's something affordable housing advocates, like Claudia Yon, understand is needed for one segment of the population.
We are moving people out of the shelter into housing option. And actually, when asked at Metro Turning Point, the guys were asked, the shelter Nova Scotia build a new building, one bedroom and bachelor, and said, oh, this will be a fight for the people. 18 or 19 men were able to move in there. No, what did they want? The smallest. Salvation Army built one room with a shared kitchen, completely happy. The guys don't want an apartment. They don't want furniture. They want a small space. They share. They don't mind sharing the kitchen. They don't want to cook. Everybody got a kitchen facility in their rooms, right? Very nice. Nobody's using it. They like to go downstairs to the cafeteria and eat there. Or they like to be together and share the things. So this is very interesting. So we have to have these choices. And the rooming house cohabitation is a really good concept that works for some.
You know, it's one of the disturbing pieces to the story is that a lot of the places that folks who are marginalized, who have addictions issues and mental health issues and usually can't find a place to live with regular landlords, so they're in rooming houses, the stock is definitely disappearing. Through fire, through selling off the properties, because they're now in areas that are being redeveloped.
The pace of getting new affordable housing built, whether offering the choice of communal-style living or not, is slow. Time's running out for that brick building in downtown Halifax, and for the 15 men living inside. EJ, for his part, would like to see people on income assistance have more money for rent. Some get the 535. Many others are only eligible for $285 a month for rent, heat, and water. EJ also wants a city and the province to get together. He told me neither is willing to really dig into this rooming house mess, to see the complexity of what's best for the Garys and Nicks and Irishes. Everyone knows what's happening, but he thinks if we put it under a microscope, we'll discover some truly horrendous living situations in our city, and ones that taxpayers are funding. What EJ really wants, you might say, is for these hidden Haligonians in their hidden homes to be seen.
Yeah, there was one I found out yesterday that is closing in 3 months, so there's another eight guys who are going to be scrambling who have been in that place for some of them for 10, 12 years.
For Maritime Magazine, I'm Leslie Lowe in Halifax.
Yeah, I don't know where they're going to end up, but I guess that's part of my job to find that out.
Our story this morning was called Hidden Homes, and Leslie Lowe joins me now from Halifax. Hi, Leslie.
Hey.
Great story, very compelling, and I'm left wondering about E.J. Davis's wishes for those 15 men.
Mm-hmm.
Any movement on the issues that he brought up?
There's been no housing allowance increase under the current NDP government, and there's none proposed. It's really quite complex because the ground shifts from time to time. There have been increases in personal allowances that look like a gain, but then when they get played out against these cutbacks to other parts of income assistance, they actually represent a net loss to a good chunk of people. So in a nutshell, no to the money issue. But Nova Scotia's Community Services Department actually released an important document this spring. It's the province's first ever affordable housing strategy. And it's the result of talking to, you know, a whole bunch of organizations and people around the province who work on the ground to fight housing insecurity. And it's big. It's a 10-year guide.
So what does it say?
Well, it says that it aims to foster a province of, quote, healthy, diverse, mixed communities. And here's the province's executive director of housing, Dan Troke.
So what we're talking about here is that you have a mix of income types, you have a mix of tenure types, meaning some folks renting, some folks owning, and a mix of family type. And what I mean by that is, you know, everything from a single individual who is looking for an opportunity in there to someone with a larger family. And so what it is it becomes about all of those different types of both from an income and from a family perspective, all finding themselves living side by side. And at the end of the day, what you don't know is who's the person who's poor and who's the person who's rich.
So, Harry, you might say it's about keeping lower-income housing and the people who need that housing in the mix. And it's not ghettoizing, which is almost a trope of old-school affordable housing. So, you know, that's really what you have in a lot of the rooming house models. Certainly Irish's Old House and the Night Magic House. These guys are not separate from the rest of their communities. They really blend in. They're part of the community. And as we heard from EJ off the top, they're close to the services they need.
So how do we get these, as you said, quote, healthy, diverse, mixed communities?
Big question. Dan Troke says the answer is to create more supply.
The more supply that's out there, the more opportunities in the middle of this, it really won't matter what your income source is. It really won't matter what your family composition is. If there is supply from different avenues and different venues that you can tap into and then say, this is what I'm working towards, and we're helping you work towards that. This is less of a conversation around how much do I make and where is the money coming from, and more about where do I want to live and what do I want for my family in the coming years. And so that's really the angle that the strategy took. Less about the income source, more about creating the opportunity.
Okay, so now here's the thing. That doesn't mean the province is launching into building a whole bunch of affordable housing. Troke says the new strategy is meant to be a catalyst.
No one really came in and said, government, you have to go fix things. But what they said is, you really have an important role to play, and here's what we'd like you to do. So the strategy kind of built up and out of that. And really, it is a 10-year strategy to let communities, at their own pace, have the conversations needed to build those healthy communities that they want to be and for the challenges of today and as those challenges evolve, kind of the communities of tomorrow.
So the big idea is that the private sector and the nonprofits are the ones, you know, they can best figure out how to make affordable housing happen. The government needs to sort of be in the background, act as support, not lead.
How likely is that to work, Leslie? Tell me about the reaction you've heard.
Really depends who you ask. One of the big complaints voiced by some community and affordable housing groups in the spring was that the document is way, way, way too vague. Doesn't say what's going to be built, where, by whom, or for whom. And one thing EJ mentions was that we never talk about housing type. He says that's how we end up failing to see the nuance of the rooming house situation we just heard about. Dan Troke says
That's on purpose. The province funds people in rooming houses if that's their preferred living arrangement. But it's not in the business of saying, this is the right place for people or this is the wrong place for people.
Truthfully, this is a strategy that is not as prescriptive of we like this or don't like that. This is more about in a community that says, modest units, if that's what you're looking for, great, how do we make that happen? And let the community and let the demand in the community drive the things that you're trying to do.
So, in short, we'll see. The strategy came out of extensive consultations with all the people who are on the street dealing with these issues. It really leaves the specifics up to the people who know what they're doing, but it also leaves them very much in the air.
Yeah, certainly. Lots to think about, Leslie. I want to thank you very much for bringing this story to us.
Anytime, Harry. Thanks.
Good job. Leslie Lowe is a freelance reporter in Halifax. You can listen to her documentary again on our website, cbc.ca/maritimemagazine. That's also a pretty good place to get in touch with us. Tell us what you thought of today's story, or send us your thoughts on anything you hear on Maritime Magazine. You can also call us at 1-800-565-5463. I'm Harry Forrestal. For producer Christina Harnett and me, thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.